Okay, so tonight we are in Judges, and we're in this section that is best defined by the very last verse of Judges, which is, in those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. That's not a compliment. That's a statement of this is the way it was, and it wasn't good. The Israelites, we've covered all of the individual stories of the judges. So now what we have at the end of the book, starting in chapter 17, has been anecdotal stories that highlight how depraved they became. There are certain incidences that you hear about and you go, man, if that is what's going on, man, what a mess. It made the news here just this week of a family, and the mom has decided that she is going to go through the whole process of transitioning her child, who's born a boy, into a girl. The dad doesn't want it, and the judge just ruled. They went to court over the whole thing, and the judge just ruled the mom can do what she wants to a 7-year-old boy. Now, that's just one story, right? That's just one story, but you read that or you hear that in the news and you go, whoa, that's a problem. That says something. That's what these stories are. They are a snapshot at the depravity of the nation at that particular time. So the first one that we had looked at was the story of Micah and his family and his own personal high priest. And so, or his own personal priest, I guess not high priest, to be fair to the story. But chapter 17 tells the story of a man who lived in the hill country of Ephraim. So that's this section right here of the land. And he had stolen some money from his mom, and then he had a attack of conscience, and he gave the money back, and mom said, oh, my boy's such a good boy, let's take that money and build an idol, and look at how great we are. And the son said, that's a great idea. And then a guy comes along, and he happens to be a Levite, and they say, we'll pay you to be our own personal priest. And the Levite says, that'd be a great idea. And so now you have this whole dynamic there. And then the Danites, who have not yet conquered all their territory, and if you look here at the map, here's Ephraim, and here's the territory of Dan. Some Danites who are coming through to conquer territory, they meet this Levite and they say, well, you know, we could pay you more money if you'll come and be our personal priest. And in fact, while you're at it, why don't you take those idols that Micah made and steal those? They'll become our gods and we'll all go over here and it'll all be great. And so the whole story you look at and you go, what on earth is going on? This is all messed up. Every part of it's messed up. That's the point. The point is, yeah, it's really a messed up time period. The next story is going to be the same way. And if anything, I think the next story illustrates how wicked the nation had become, because it is a very natural side-by-side with Sodom and Gomorrah and the events that happened there. And you look at this story that we'll read in chapter 19 and 20, and you look at that and you go, that just sounds exactly like Sodom and Gomorrah. And we know what God thought about them, and we know what God did to them. So now here's Israel. They've come into the land. They've conquered this territory because all of the people, their sins have become full and they've been wicked. Couple hundred years go by, and now we're looking at them doing a lot of the exact same depraved behavior. So this is illustrating that particular idea. So in chapter 19, it will begin with saying, it came about in those days when there was no king in Israel, there was a certain Levite staying in the remote part of the hill country of Ephraim, who took a concubine for himself from Bethlehem in Judah. You'll notice actually a lot of these stories, the central area is Ephraim, which is illustrates two things. One, Ephraim will become kind of the capital area later on of the divided nation. But also, if you're looking at the map of Israel, Ephraim, where is it? It's right in the middle, isn't it? Right smack dab in the middle. So it's not like, oh, it happened on the fringes of the country. No, it's happened right in the middle of it, right just in the heartland of it. So it says he took a concubine for himself from Bethlehem in Judah, but his concubine played the harlot against him, and she went away from him to her father's house in Bethlehem in Judah and was there for a period of 4 months. Okay, so first of all, before we go any further, you have this Levite. He has a concubine from Bethlehem. She ends up running away with him from him, plays a harlot, goes to stay with her dad. What's the quality of these individuals? Low quality morals, right? Every aspect of this is not as it ought to be already. And he's going to be like the good guy in the story. That's the scary thing. Like, this is the good guy. And so he goes to get his concubine, and he goes after her, and it says that he speaks tenderly to her, and she will then bring him into her father's house, and he'll have this time with the girl's father, and the dad will detain them in hopes that they'll stay for a little longer. So verse 4, it says, he remained with him 3 days, and they ate and drank and lodged there. So here they are in they are foreigners, or at least this man is a foreigner in Ephraim. He's a Levite, and he's staying there in his father-in-law's place. And so on the fourth day, they got up early in the morning and prepared to go. And the girl's father said to his son-in-law, "Sustain yourself with a piece of bread, and afterwards you may go." So he tries to detain him again, and again he does it. And then eventually, after a few more days of this, in verse 10 it says, "But the man was not willing to spend the night, so he arose and departed and came to a place opposite Jebus, that is Jerusalem." So eventually this man leaves, and when he leaves, he doesn't have enough time to make it all the way home to his home territory because he left late. And so he's going to stay somewhere opposite Jerusalem. So we're now over here in the territory right over by Jerusalem, which is right there. It says in verse 11, "When they were near Jebus, the day was almost gone, and the servant said to his master, 'Please come, let us turn aside in the city of the Jebusites and spend the night in it.'" So it's getting close to nighttime. Let's stay here. However, his master said to him, "We will not turn aside into the city of foreigners who are not of the sons of Israel, but we will go on as far as Gibeah." So now, this is one of the focal points of the story is, this man says, let's not stay in Jebus, which is Jerusalem. So we're not going to stay in that area because it's not Israelites who live there. We won't go to a foreigner city because, if you remember, Jerusalem has not yet been conquered by the Israelites. So it's still inhabited by the people of the land. So he said, no, we'll keep going. We'll go all the way on down to Gibeah. And so his thought is, we wouldn't stay in a city of a foreigner. They might mistreat us, so that's not the place to go. We'll move on. And so it says in verse 14, "They passed along, went there, and the sun set on them near Gibeah, which belongs to Benjamin. They turned aside there in order to enter and lodge in Gibeah. When they entered, they sat down in the open square of the city, for no one took them into his house to spend the night." Now, if you know anything about the history, and I think we've mentioned this in previous classes, in that part of the world, under Eastern culture, if you came into a town, what was expected? Somebody's going to take you in. That was the expected part of the culture. Now, that doesn't happen here. So right off the bat, we say, well, wait a second. They went into Israelite territory, into where the tribe of Benjamin is. They settle in the open square, and nobody takes them in. And then it says, "Then behold, an old man was coming out of the field from his work at evening. And the man was from the hill country of Ephraim, and he was staying in Gibeah. But the men of the place were Benjamites. And he lifted up his eyes and saw the traveler in the open square of the city. And the old man said, 'Where are you going, and where do you come from?' And he said, 'We're passing from Bethlehem and Judah to the remote part of the hill country of Ephraim, for I am from there. And I went to Bethlehem and Judah, but I'm now going to my house, and no man will take me into his house.'" And he'll go on to mention, "I have supplies for myself. I brought, I'm not asking for anybody to provide for me. I'll bring my own food for myself and my wife and my animals. The old man says in verse 20, peace to you, only let me take care of all your needs. However, do not spend the night in the open square. So he took him into his house, gave the donkeys fodder, they washed their feet and ate and drank. You can already begin to see the parallels between this and the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. In the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, the two angels travel into the city of Sodom and Gomorrah, and who takes them in there? Lot. And if Lot hadn't done it, who was going to? Nobody. So this old man says, no, I'll take you in. Don't spend the night in the open square. It's like he might know something that this guy doesn't. And it says, he takes them in. And it says, verse 22, while they were celebrating, behold, the men of the city, certain worthless fellows, surrounded the house, pounding the door. And they spoke to the owner of the house, the old man, saying, bring out the man who came into your house so we may have relations with him. So this is exact parallel of the things you saw in Sodom and Gomorrah with the angels. The man, the owner of the house, went out to them and said, no, my fellows, please do not act so wickedly. Since this man has come into my house, do not commit this act of folly. Here is my virgin daughter and his concubine. Please let me bring them out that you may ravish them and do to them whatever you wish. But do not commit such an act of folly against this man. So once again, what are we seeing? Are we seeing high quality individuals? He said, no, protect this guy. Instead, I'll give you my daughter and this man's concubine. High quality individuals, right? the whole story's ugly. That's the point here. This is not a story of the good guys and the bad guys. It's the bad guys and the badder guys. It's the wicked and the depraved. And so it says in verse 24, here's my virgin daughter, his concubine. Please let me bring them out that you may ravish them and do to them whatever you wish, but do not commit such an act of folly against this man. But the men would not listen to him, so the man seized his concubine, brought her out to them, and they raped her and abused her all night until morning, and then let her go at the approach of dawn. Just horrific events. And as the day began to dawn, the woman came and fell down at the doorway of the man's house where her master was until full daylight. And when her master arose in the morning and opened the doors of the house and went out to go on his way, then behold, his concubine was lying at the doorway of the house with her hands on the threshold. And he said to her, get up and let us go. I don't know any man of any quality who could have, because it says the man arose the next morning, which tells you, what did he do that night? He went to sleep. I can't imagine any man of any fiber of quality being able to do that, knowing what had transpired with a woman outside his door. Forget that it's even his concubine. I mean, just any woman. So he tells her, get up, let's go. There's obviously not a great deal of sympathy or care. And then, but it says there was no answer, the reason being that she is dead. And it says, then he placed her on the donkey, and the man arose and went to his home. And when he entered his house, he took a knife and he laid hold of his concubine and cut her in 12 pieces, limb by limb, and sent her throughout the territory of Israel. All who saw it said, nothing like this has ever happened or been seen from the day when the sons of Israel came up from the land of Egypt to this day. Consider it, take counsel, and speak up. So he decides that this is, apparently there was an acceptance of them ravishing and raping her, but the fact that they had killed her, he decides that is so despicable, we now need to spread the word. So he cuts her into 12 parts, that's representing the 12 tribes, and sends them to each tribe. And everybody, when they see it, they say, wow, this is, nothing like this has ever happened. So it is a moment where the nation goes, wow, things are very, very bad. Now the nation has to make a decision. And so what they choose to do is they choose to rise up. It says in chapter 20, verse 1, all the sons of Israel from Dan to Beersheba, that's from the very northern most city in Dan to the southernmost city down in Beersheba, which is right here. They are all going to rise up. And it says the congregation assembled as one man to the Lord at Mizpah. The chiefs of all the people, even of all the tribes of Israel, took their stand in the assembly of people God. 400,000 foot soldiers who drew the sword. Now the sons of Benjamin heard that the sons of Israel had gone up to Mizpah. And the sons of Israel said, "Tell us, how did this wickedness take place?" The man will then tell his story. And they will, in verse 5, it says, "The men of Gibeah rose up against me and surrounded the house at night because of me." He'll tell his story and say it was a lewd, in verse 6, a lewd and disgraceful act in all of Israel. And he'll end by saying, "Behold, all you sons of Israel, give your advice and counsel here." So the people will arise as one man, and they will have a sense of righteous indignation, which is good. But how bad did it have to get in order for that righteous indignation to strike up? I mean, that's part of the problem. How calloused must you be against wickedness that it doesn't bother you until it gets to this point? And they decide that as one man, they're going to fight against Gibeah. And so what we end up having is a civil war. And it says in verse 17 of this chapter 20, "The men of Israel besides Benjamin were numbered 400,000 men who draw the sword. All these were men of war." And it will describe the battle between Benjamin and Israel. And when Israel goes to fight against Benjamin, Benjamin is actually pretty impressive warriors. It will list how they are pretty impressive warriors. And the first time they go out to battle, the Benjamites will kill 22,000 men of Israel. And then the second day they go out to battle, Benjamin will kill 18,000 men of Israel. And in verse 26 it says, "Then all the sons of Israel and all the people went up and came to Bethel and wept. Thus they remained there before the Lord and fasted that day until evening, and they offered burnt offerings and peace offerings before the Lord. The sons of Israel inquired of the Lord, for the Ark of the Covenant of God was there in those days, and Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, Aaron's son, stood before it to minister in those days, saying, 'Shall I yet again go out to battle against the sons of my brother Benjamin, or shall I cease?' And the Lord said, 'Go up, for tomorrow I'll deliver them into your hand.'" So eventually Benjamin will be destroyed. Down in verse 35, "The Lord struck Benjamin before Israel, so the sons of Israel destroyed 25,100 men of Benjamin that day, all who draw the sword." So if you add up and do the math, 25,000 or so Benjamites, eight, and then the first 2 days you have of Israel, the other tribes, 18,000 and 22,000. You have roughly 70,000 people die. Now, unlike, and this is another one of those things that this story illustrates, in the past, when Israel has gone to battle against a wicked foe, and in this case, is Benjamin a wicked foe? They are, right? Because they're protecting Gibeah and this horrific behavior. In the past, when Israel has done that, how's the victory gone, say, with Jericho or the kings of the north or the kings of the south? It's been pretty lopsided, hasn't it? Israel knocks them out in a landslide because God is with them and not with their wicked foe. But in this case, we don't see that. We see that there is civil war, there's death on both sides, and that's even the case with God saying, "No, go and fight them." Why might that be? Why would there be so much bloodshed? I think that's the only answer that makes sense. You don't have Israel's really good and Benjamin's really evil. You have Israel is pretty evil and Benjamin has chosen a eviler path. And so there's this war that is an internal destruction because of the sin of the whole nation. Once again, we're illustrating how dark things had gotten. We've fallen quite a long way from the days of Joshua leading them to defeat places like Jericho and the walls falling down flat. It will eventually describe further destruction of the Benjamites. You get down to let's Let's see, about verse 44. Yeah, there, verse 44 is the next time we'll see numbers. Thus, 18,000 men of Benjamin fell. So now we're getting up to about 90,000 or so. All these were valiant warriors. The rest turned and fled toward the wilderness, the rock of Rimmon. But they caught 5,000 of them on the highways and overtook them at Gittim and killed 2,000 of them. So all of Benjamin who fell that day were 25,000. Men who draw the sword, all these were valiant warriors, but 600 men turned and fled toward the wilderness to Rock of Rimmon, and they remained at the Rock of Rimmon 4 months. The men of Israel then turned back against the sons of Benjamin and struck them with the edge of the sword, both the entire city with the cattle and all that they found. They also set on fire all the cities which they found. So now, there's death and destruction all around. It's lots of wickedness and horrible things happening. And ultimately, the city that perpetrated this, Gibeah, ends up receiving this type of punishment that we see the nations that they kicked out of the land got. I mean, wasn't that how it was when they went and kicked out people out of the land? He said, when you go in and destroy the city, how much of it do you destroy? You just wipe the whole thing out, all of it. Well, now we're seeing that happening to themselves. It's a picture of that depravity. In chapter 21, we now have this new problem that's created by this sin, which is the men of Israel had sworn in Mizpah, saying, none of us shall give his daughter to Benjamin in marriage. So the people came to Bethel and sat there before God until evening and lifted up their voices and wept bitterly. And they said, why, O Lord God of Israel, has this come about in Israel so that one tribe should be missing today in Israel? By the way, we can answer that question. Why, O God, has this happened? It's a wicked sin. That's why. You know, sometimes the answer is, why did this horrible thing happen? It's because you did the wrong thing. I mean, that's the answer in this story. When you pan back and look at the big picture, it's because of wickedness. It's because of sin. And so now they have this issue that Benjamin all the other tribes have said, we won't intermarry with them. And so the fear is that Benjamin will begin to dwindle out and disappear. And so you'll be down to 11 tribes because of this vow they've made. And so they now have to make a decision. So in verse 6, it says, the sons of Israel were sorry for their brother Benjamin and said, one tribe is cut off from Israel today. What shall we do for our wives, for those who are left, since we have sworn by the Lord not to give them any of our daughters in marriage? So now, how are we going to fix this problem? So you have a tribe, they can't... There are no daughters to marry them because of what has been sworn. So what's the most righteous solution you can think of? Well, what's their solution? Yeah, you can steal them. That becomes the answer. We're going to have a big parade, and we're going to tell you Benjamites when the parade is. You come out, you mug our daughters and drag them off, and we'll let you marry them. The nation's in a great spot, isn't it? See, every piece of this is just to lay out, that's your solution? That's how you're going to deal with this? And so it just highlights that problem all the way through. And so at the very end of all of this, after all of these things, you get down to verse 24, and it says, the sons of Israel departed from there at that time, every man to his tribe and family, and each one of them went out from there to his inheritance. And in those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. So this ends the account of Judges by giving us this picture of exactly how fouled up they got. Now, to give you an idea, this is a long period of time that we've covered in a short period of time. For us, we just read chapter, and there you go. For them, this is 250 years or more. 250 years is kind of the minimum for it. So if you put that in the context of history we do know, America is roughly 250 years old. How much has America changed from its founding in 1776 to now? Are there any significant changes? It's pretty profound, and it doesn't happen overnight. It happens slowly over time. We should remember as we go through a book like Judges, that's exactly what happened to them. This is real history. It didn't happen overnight. This isn't just, you know, one day they're righteous and godly and let's go take the land. And then the exact same group of people says, let's go cut concubines into 12 pieces. This is a change that's happened by generations and a great deal of wickedness that is slowly piled up as they've turned their back on God. So with that in mind, that really covers the book of Judges. Does anybody have any comments or questions? Yes. Right.
And then they're battling Canaan. And so, like, looking at the bookend, you go from, like, God's victory to the civil war. It's very perfect contrast.
It is. That's exactly it. And that's really what's being pictured, is we went from the people who conquered the land, one tribe after the other, going up to win the victories, to now they're going up against each other and destroying their own cities that have acted like Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities of these people whose sins have been fully kicked out. So it is. It's a total flip to the other side and mirrored, reflected in both sides. Any other comments or questions? Okay. Well, then, with that in mind, we'll close down this class.